Mit HubSpot und der integrierten KI erledigst du mehr als je zuvor. Dank Breeze Agents schaffst du in wenigen Sekunden, was sonst Stunden dauert. Und mit Breeze Copilot bist du immer 2 Schritte voraus. Mit den richtigen Insights zur richtigen Zeit. Starte jetzt auf hubspot.de/KI.
Wann hast du zuletzt eine Stelle besetzt und gedacht, das war einfach? Wahrscheinlich lange her. Recruiting kann echt kompliziert sein. Es geht aber auch anders. Die Recruiting-Plattform Instafo liefert dir dank AI-Matchmaking nur passende Bewerbungen in deine Pipeline und per Chat kannst du direkt mit ihnen kommunizieren. Instafo erreicht über Podcasts, Reddit, YouTube und Co. Talente, die sonst schwer zu finden sind. Funktioniert für Enterprises wie RTL und GLS, aber auch für Scale-Ups wie Do Instruct und Finanzguru. Du zahlst nur bei Erfolg und sparst über instafo.com/podcast 500 Euro bei deiner ersten Einstellung. Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Knicks? What the fuck Tuckians? Yes, what the fuck Tuckians? I'm in what the fuck Kentucky. What the fuck Tucky? What, I'm here. I'm taping this in your state. How's it going? I'll just ask that to the world. How are all you WTF people doing? How is it going out there? Is it a day-to-day slog through fear and hopelessness and panic and food and more food and some movies and some doom scrolling and some fear and some panic and some hopelessness and, oh, hey, look, come here, buddy, come here. That's it. Pet the dog. Hey, 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 pet the cat. Fear, hopelessness, panic, food. More food. How about an errand? Yeah, let's go pick up the thing at the place. All right, great. Oh, I love it. Panic, fear, food. How about another movie? Okay, what's going on? I'm just trying to recap the days. I have been out on the road, as you can hear. I'm not in the garage. I'm in a high-ceilinged hotel room that it looks like it's literally built to have echo and bounce. So enjoy that. I am in, right now, I am recording in Lexington, Kentucky, before my show yesterday. I will say this trip has been, it's been interesting and odd to me to travel in the South in this new world that we are entering, being dragged into. Maybe I should say that. Before I start rambling, I'd like to say that I have Carrie Coon on the show. She's been on the series like The Leftovers, The Gilded Age, Fargo. She's in movies like Gone Girl, The Nest, and His Three Daughters. You can see her now on the new season of White Lotus. She's married to Tracy Letts, the brilliant actor and playwright, who, for some WTF trivia, out of all the guests that I've had on this show over the years, people always ask me, do you hang out with any of them after? You know, not comics, not guys I already know, but have I made friends with anybody who has been on the show? And yes, Tracy Letts is my friend. And I can say that with confidence. And I am today interviewing his brilliant wife, who is a great actress. So there you go. It's all set up. I want to sneak this in too before I start babbling aimlessly. I will be at Largo tomorrow night in Los Angeles. I just want to make sure that that's out there because I feel like I've not worn out my welcome in LA, but I feel like everybody who wants to see me has seen me here or in LA. And that they assume that, you know, like, well, is he going to do the same stuff? I rarely do the same set. But I do want to put that out there. Largo at the Coronet tomorrow night in Los Angeles. That's Tuesday, February 25th. Then I got another Red State run. I'll be in Oklahoma City at the Tower Theater on Thursday, March 6th. Dallas, I'm at the Majestic Theater Friday, March 7th. I'll be in Houston at the White Oak Music Hall on Saturday, March 8th. San Antonio at the Empire Theater on Sunday, March 9th. Yeah, San Antonio. Look, I don't know how many of you listen or give a shit, but you know, that show's looking a little lighter than I'd like. I don't want it to be a strange, isolated experience for the diehards that come. So I'm not begging. I'm just trying to get it out there. Maybe you didn't hear me say it, but San Antonio, all right, you listening? Empire Theater, Sunday, March 9th, and then I'm going to South by Southwest to let everybody watch a fairly detailed and thorough documentary about me. And some of the subtexts are my inability to pull my pants up. You know, look for that. If you're seeing the documentary, chart the sort of drooping of Mark's pants. I don't know why I think no one notices that. I mean, I feel like I pull them up enough, and I feel more comfortable when they're a little low, but I'm not looking for them to hang out on, you know, off of my ass, you know, just hang. I like the doc. You know, it's hard to watch myself, but yeah, maybe there's a little Easter egg in there for you. Is that what you call them? At some point, keep an eye out, because you will, towards the end of the film, see my naked ass because I'm bending over to put something in the oven. Just look out for it. It's a big payoff after an hour of just, you know, drooping pants to finally get the punchline. I will be in Durham, North Carolina at the Carolina Theater of Durham on Friday, March 21st. I'll be in Charlotte, North Carolina at the Knight Theater on Saturday, March 22nd. And Charleston, South Carolina. I'm at the Charleston Music Hall on Sunday, March 23rd. Little Mark Maron trivia. The last time I was in Charleston, and that show could use some people too, but I'm not expecting massive Maron crowds in thoroughly red places. But the last time I did Charleston, some guy brought a pre-psychotic Nancy Mace to the show. She was always Republican, but there was a point there where she was relatively reasonable, and now she's just a fucking clown. But someone brought her to my show. She was there on a date with a guy who was a fan of mine, and after the show, I remember meeting her, and she was slightly panicked. She said, "I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know what I'm doing at this show. I don't know what I'm doing here." And just frenetic, a little bit frenetic. I'm glad that she got to see me and that I delivered the goods into that jumbled, attention-seeking, morally bankrupt brain of hers. I'm coming to Illinois, Michigan, Toronto, Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York City for my special taping. So you can go to WTFpod.com/tour for any of my dates and links to tickets. So that's that. That's where we're at. So I've been trying to do some reading out here on the road, and I've been reading Sidney Lumet's book about directing movies, which has been helpful. I've really kind of taken my time doing that homework, because hopefully I will be directing a film towards the beginning of next year. And I've been reading How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them by Jason Stanley, which, you know, I was only about halfway through, and then I realized, like, I don't know if I need to finish it, because I can just pick up where the book left off with my news feed. Yes, kind of a joke, but kind of not, right? Kind of, right? I'm not enjoying this space for recording, but this is what it's going to be. So yeah, I've been out here. I've been in the South. I've toured the South many times before. I've been down here a lot. I always have. I always end up being paranoid and wondering about how I'll be received or what the people are like down here. And generally in the past, I've come away thinking like, well, those crowds were great and everybody seemed real nice, and I had a nice time seeing everybody, and, you know, I had no problems. This time, whether it's my mind or reality, not as comfortable. Not as comfortable. Though the crowds have been great, truly great. I mean, Asheville at the Orange Peel was spectacular. Love the people of Asheville. I saw my buddy Stan and Lori. They got a house over there, and I took a ride down where the floods were and kind of addressed, you know, the fires and talked about natural disasters with the audience, but the place was packed, and it's a sweet town, and it seems to be bouncing back. And my people came out because they are there. It is a kind of blue dot, as they call them. I'm a little bit concerned with the blue dots being erased somehow. But then again, I'm concerned about all of us being erased somehow, at least in our ability to speak and organize publicly. And then after Asheville, Ali Makovsky and I, my opener, drove to Nashville. That was quite a ride. Quite a ride. I'd never taken that ride through the Blue Mountains, through Appalachia. Is that how you say it? I used to say Appalachia, but I think it's Appalachia. And it's beautiful in a very kind of rugged way, but the nature is beautiful. The small towns are a little beat up, but picturesque, and you can make assumptions about the history there, or you can make assumptions about whatever's happening now. But I do know one thing that I've experienced traveling through the South this time is that it is very rural in most places and very spread out. And, you know, it's not congested in any way. The smaller cities certainly aren't. They're a little bit congested, but they're small. And everything is very spread out, you know, one or two houses, sometimes for hundreds of acres. And I don't, you know, I know that this is whatever this part of America is, however you want to refer to it, a flyover state or the South or whatever, or rural America. And I understand that's what a lot of the country looks like. But I do not guess I understand, you know, why they're so worked up about the foundations of democracy functioning. They live, it seems, fairly isolated lives. And I think that, you know, they just fill their brains with garbage. And as I move through this tour, I've been down here 5 days in the South and moving through the South. It's felt like a month. And it weighs heavy on me that, you know, that I like living in a large city. And I know that on some levels to the people that live in these other places, we're the enemy, we live in a bubble, but our bubble may be a very large bubble in terms of the scope and size of the city, but it is, you know, a functioning democratic bubble in a lot of ways because the city I live in is very well integrated and there's all kinds of people there, thousands of them. And I find that comforting and human and tolerant and all the things that seems to be on the menu for, you know, getting rid of. And it's really not about, you know, an arrogance or an elitism or anything else. It's just, I like being around a lot of different kinds of people who have different paths, different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different approaches to life and food and everything else. It just seems to be a celebration of humanity. We're out here, I don't know. It's pretty one-dimensional in a lot of ways. And I just think a lot of the fury is stoked by misinformation that they get from the thing that they hold in their hand or else from the thing that they watch. I don't know, but it's weighing heavy on me this trip, moving through these areas. Oh, another high point of the trip. Another high point of the trip. I had done a tour with Ali before, and we had driven by a Buc-ee's, I think somewhere on the coast of California. And she goes, have you been to Buc-ee's? And I'm like, I have not been to Buc-ee's. And she goes, you got to go to Buc-ee's, but we'd already passed it. And I'm like, all right, someday I'll go to Buc-ee's. And we were in, I guess we were driving from maybe Asheville to Nashville. And there was a sign for a Buc-ee's. And she said, we got to go. And I'm like, it's a truck stop, right? She goes, no, it's its own thing. It is a truck stop, but it's like the Walmart of truck stops. I have never seen anything like it. And I'm happy I went to Buc-ee's because it's like going to the America that you don't get when you live on the coast or in a city. It is something. Buc-ee's, the logo is a beaver. It's a little beaver, a cute little beaver guy. And this truck stop is huge. All right. They have all the things a truck stop has, but much more. I can't even describe it. I stood before the wall of jerky. There's an entire wall of packaged jerky. And I'm talking a wall of jerky, which would be a good name for an album or perhaps a band. So there's a wall of jerky, and then they have sort of a butcher shop set up with some meats, but mostly jerky in the case, all kinds of jerky. And then there's a food station in the middle where they make brisket sandwiches, egg sandwiches, like, and people love the brisket. Huge food court within the Buc-ee's, okay? And across from the wall of jerky, there's the faith-based boutique, I guess you would call it, with, you know, a lot of kind of Christian-oriented fun T-shirts. And then they have the Buc-ee's T-shirts. And then they have the coffee station. And then they have, you know, other clothing. And then they have, you know, the cigarette counter. And it is, if you want to just shrink a Walmart a little bit and make it everything that a truck stop has, but much more, that's Buc-ee's. And you get a, you know, you do get a sense, you know, there again, back in the day, if I would have gone to the South, I would have thought like, well, look at all these, you know, people are just traveling. They're just nice people, but it's very hard to separate my sense of why this country is heading the direction it's headed from the people standing with me before the jerky wall. But again, I don't want to be judgmental or divisive, but I think it's too late. I think we are divided and heavily judging each other, and the victors are going to eliminate our ability to judge publicly. I'm just talking, you know, that's all, just chatting. So look, Carrie Coon is my guest, and it was exciting to have the conversation with her that I had. She's on season 3 of White Lotus, with new episodes airing Sunday nights on HBO. You can stream it on Max. And this is me talking to Carrie Coon.
Mit HubSpot und der integrierten KI erledigst du mehr als je zuvor. Dank Breeze Agents schaffst du in wenigen Sekunden, was sonst Stunden dauert. Und mit Breeze Copilot bist du immer 2 Schritte voraus. Mit den richtigen Insights zur richtigen Zeit. Starte jetzt auf hubspot.de/KI.
Wann hast du zuletzt eine Stelle besetzt und gedacht, das war einfach? Wahrscheinlich lange her. Recruiting kann echt kompliziert sein. Es geht aber auch anders. Die Recruiting-Plattform Instafo liefert dir dank AI-Matchmaking nur passende Bewerbungen in deine Pipeline, und per Chat kannst du direkt mit ihnen kommunizieren. Instafo erreicht über Podcasts, Reddit, YouTube und Co. Talente, die sonst schwer zu finden sind. Funktioniert für Enterprises wie RTL und GLS, aber auch für Scale-Ups wie du, Instruct und Finanzguru. Du zahlst nur bei Erfolg und sparst über instafo.com/podcast 500 Euro bei deiner ersten Einstellung.
My voice, I've had this fucking flu A, man. This
what?
Is 3 weeks.
What is it?
My voice is
what am I gonna
destroyed.
Get? What did you?
You're going to get the sick, sexy version of me.
What was it? A flu voice? A flu A?
It's influenza A. It's what all the kids at school had. So what, my kids got it. I got it. Tracy got it. We all got it.
Yeah.
My voice hasn't come back.
Really?
No.
That's the thing about kids.
And I'm doing press.
You
oh, God. You're just sick all the time.
Sick all the time.
Yeah,
it sounds
totally.
Great.
And they recover. Thank you. They recover so fast, the kids.
But it's rewarding, right?
I've become a real like pro-natalist person. I believe in having children, but I also believe now maybe you shouldn't, because we're all going to die.
But that's practical.
But I also believe it doesn't matter where they go to school or anything.
Because, it doesn't?
No, because it's a fucking like the world we grew up in doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah,
so we don't have a paradigm for my children's lives.
Yeah, but you have one at home, no?
What do you mean? Like an idea of how we'd like to raise them?
Sure.
Building a Mormon pantry. And sure, yeah, treat people how you wish to be treated. And also get ready. You're going to have to distill water with a tarp and a hole.
Yeah, so you
and, like,
give them that?
And, like, shoot people to protect your food. Not yet. No,
oh, yeah.
I'm protecting them from that right now.
So wait.
Someday
age?
They're going to look at me and say, and what were you doing when the world was on fire?
Sure.
And I'm going to say, insulating our house and, you know, converting to heat pumps.
Sure, and thinking about opening a boutique of some kind.
Oh, God.
That's not you.
No, God.
But
no.
But so the prepper mentality happens when they're in their teens, probably.
Probably.
Yeah, you're gonna buy.
I mean,
guns
there's probably some camp I can send them to soon that will start to teach them how to make a fire or skin a squirrel.
Unfortunately, it might come with an ideology you're not happy with.
I mean, look, it's a fine line these days.
Is it?
Yeah, the far right and the far left are closer than ever.
Yeah, it's come full circle.
It has.
People always say that, but I think there is still some distinction.
I agree. I don't, you know, there aren't just like entire groups of people I want to put on a train, sent to a camp. Well, maybe I'm slowly moving that way too. But
which people would they be?
I'm not going to say that, but they're some of my people. Honestly, though, I do think there's no paradigm. I think the world our kids will live in is horrendous. I mean, if you're paying any attention to climate scientists, which you know,
sure.
You know what we're in for. It's devastating.
Yeah, I know. I just,
you can't think about it all the time.
Well, there was always this hope that I'd get out under the wire.
Right.
But I don't have kids. So, you know.
You could take the pill. Tracy's taking the pill. He's like, I'm cyanide pill. I'm out. I'm not
really?
Fighting. Yeah, he's not going to
so
fight. He's like, I'm too old for
cyanide online?
This. Not yet. But, you know, we're not there yet. I'm just, it's all like, you know, on a little graph paper, plans.
Yeah, I don't understand completely the sort of idea of prepping for the end so you can live after it. What's
right.
that life? How's
well,
that
here's
quality
the thing,
of
Mark. When you have kids, you have to consider how to keep your children alive.
Yeah.
Because that's your fundamental responsibility.
And that's
I'm going to have to do that by myself because he's going to take the pill and just like conk out.
I think you could talk him out of it.
I don't think so. He's
really?
Pretty
he's
committed.
Pretty committed?
Yeah, I mean, he's had a very full life, Mark, you know.
He really has,
he's been very
he?
Successful.
It's annoying that he's younger
sort of
than me.
Empty and meaningless, though, is the thing.
Is it?
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
I mean, you'd like to think it matters for a little while. If you can get
sure,
it 6 months.
For a little
no,
while.
But 6 months of recognition and you
yeah,
think
you're
you change
Hollywood,
things.
That's about right.
You move the sort of artistic ball forward a bit.
Yeah, I guess. I guess you get the power of no. Like, you get to say no to things. That's the real. Isn't
no,
that
but
like
I mean,
the
like,
glorious power?
I mean, outside of acting, when you write a play,
right.
you'd like to think that has a place in the world that will outlive you.
I do believe that my husband,
yeah.
he still hopelessly believes in the power of art. He believes in it more than I do.
Well, I mean, I think that real artists have to believe that.
I
get cynical about it because I'm like, yeah, so what song's going to get us out of this?
Right.
You know,
yeah,
which,
yeah, totally.
Which play that no one goes to is going to change
well,
the tide of fascism?
Well, that's what Tracy said. I mean, the last play he wrote was about fascism. He's like, literally nobody came.
Yeah.
And when it was still running, the New York Times didn't even write about it.
Yeah, so that's going like, to work. That's yeah, going to hold the line.
He's like, so if nobody saw my fascism play, I guess I'm done.
Yeah, if no one sees a fascism play, does it happen?
Yeah. If a fascism play
which
is done
play was
in the
that?
Woods. The Minutes. Did you not see The Minutes?
I don't think I did
oh,
see
Oh, Mark,
the
it's so good.
It's hard for me to see theater out here. I did go see
it's
Linda
hard for me
Vista.
To see theater in New York. Yes, yeah, I know you saw it out here. But
that was great.
Yeah, I know. It's such a, I mean, it's a Steely Dan. He's a character in a Steely
well,
Dan
Well, him and
song.
I, we split paths on that, on the Steely
sure,
Dan.
Sure, sure. Right. I know it's one of your fundamental disagreements in your friendship.
No, I understand Steely Dan.
Right.
I don't freak out over them.
Nor do I.
But he's younger than me, and we're not quite boomers yet. He shouldn't you know adapt
we're
all
the same.
That.
We're
adopt
like
it
kind
all.
Of opposite ends of the same generation.
So you think about this end of the world thing all the time?
Yes.
And what yes. are you trying to really do? Have you reconciled it in a real way?
No. I think, you know, isn't sort of the responsibility of any human being to prepare yourself for death?
Yeah.
So I feel like I think about death all the time in order to prepare myself for the inevitability of the dissolution of everything around us.
Well, let me ask you a question.
So I can be at peace with it.
Well, be at peace with your own death, but then be at peace with, you know, the planetary death or you
well,
know, the
yeah.
death in, you know, starving in a camp somewhere.
Right, exactly.
Because you're an actress.
Yes. Yeah, I'll be on the train for sure. Absolutely.
Is it going to be trains?
I don't know. Not anymore.
I guess our
infrastructure is really broken down.
Yeah,
we don't really have
the
infrastructure for the trains.
But I mean, in terms of like really dealing with that death thing, I mean, as an actor person, because I feel like I can intellectually wrap my brain around
right.
it, but to really fear really feel the terror of it, that's all a different story. Like I somehow another one night in bed, I'd got myself into a situation where I was pretty sure I had cancer, and I felt the terror of it.
Yes,
and it made me realize like I'm not prepared for this at all.
Yeah, I think that's real. Tracy's went through a couple of health scares like that, but for him it was like, oh, my children are so young
now.
Right.
That's, now that was
now,
him.
Now for him it's about his kids.
Well, they both happened when he was when or
yeah
he had
after
the kid.
He had children. Yeah,
really.
So he was really. You know, he's
something
had other brushes
for.
With death, but
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, now it's like, that's a very different thing is to think about how you, what you do to sustain your children in the event of your death, or if you're leaving your children too soon.
But what about some spiritual foundation? Anything?
We really struggle with that because I'm a recovering Catholic, and Tracy's
full on Catholic.
My dad almost became a Catholic priest. He went to Borromeo Seminary in Cleveland. He and my mom went out to dinner and got engaged because they've been making out since fourth grade. And always took us to church. And he got us confirmed and we were baptized. My mom didn't go to church.
Swinging orbs, outfits.
Yeah, we did all this stuff. Yeah. You know, in Ohio, as committed as they would
Ohio
be in
Ohio. Catholics, yeah.
And his family's very Catholic, his side of the family. So my mom's mom was a scientist. She was a science teacher. She didn't let any of the chaplains in her room when she was dying. She was like, get the fuck out of here.
Really?
Yeah, no, she was not interested. She wanted to donate her body to science.
So no hell that you believed?
I mean, no, I absolutely, all I wanted, Mark, was a statue of Mary to talk to me. I just wanted to be special. I was a middle child. Nobody was paying any attention. And I wanted, I just wanted to I feel like all the women teaching catechism talked about was like Mary appearing in Medjugorje.
Yeah, sure.
I was like, is that really what it's about? Or how girls shouldn't play sports because it would damage our reproductive organs, which fly with me. Yeah, that was really a thing they were teaching me. And I was like, I like sports.
Yeah.
I mean, I looked like a boy till I was 17 and a half.
Did you have a hell? Did you believe it?
Yeah, sure.
Wow.
It's very romantic.
Yeah, fun.
I mean, are you kidding me? Like the power of guilt and shame in my life up until I was probably 30 was so...
Up until this morning.
Ruined everything.
It's coming back later today, I'm sure.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
But the guilt and shame religious as opposed to just free-floating is probably more specific.
I mean, guilt and shame is also like a parenting strategy that people relied on for decades, I think. Like that's how you imparted like the moral... Right, your moral is all based
terrify
on guilt
them.
And shame.
Hate yourself for doing this.
Yeah, self-loathing.
Tell Jesus to forgive you.
And also people-pleasing. Just don't make waves, ladies.
Yeah.
You know, that was a real thing.
Yeah, but
it's still a real thing.
It didn't stick with you.
No, because I did some work on myself and I met somebody who I fundamentally realized could like handle anything I had, which I never believed. I didn't trust anyone before that.
I don't either.
No, that's a real thing, Mark. But you can work on it.
Yeah, but so with the work you did, what was it that you couldn't trust them with? Was it real or was it just some weird childlike thing that the fear wasn't practical
well,
anymore?
Well, it's real insofar as it's impacting your life. I mean, I think when you're growing up in the Midwest and my
Where'd
parents,
you grow up?
I grew up in Ohio. There were five kids in my family.
Which town?
It's called Copley. It's outside of Akron. So it's like Akron's a very urban area, but we were in a very rural area that had been in my family since the 1800s.
But it's pretty, right?
It's beautiful. I loved growing up
since
in that
Since the 1800s?
Place. Yeah, my dad's family lived on that property,
Was
actually.
It a farm?
Yeah, it was a farm. Everybody
Where'd they come from? Scandinavia?
Oh, no. I mean, my dad's family's mostly, like my grandma was some French.
Oh,
and,
really?
You know, they're all like European mutts. And my mom's side was mostly Hungarian.
Wasn't part of the Midwest Swede invasion?
No.
It wasn't the Lutherans?
I don't have much of that, I don't think.
Oh, yeah.
No, I think I'm more Neanderthal than Swede.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How does that impact you?
Well, it's just,
Midwest.
I mean, my parents were raised by people who grew up in the Depression. And they worked. My parents worked full time.
Like what they
did? My mom was an emergency room nurse.
Oh, my
dad
God.
Ran the family auto parts store because he didn't become a priest. So then he had to find, a vocation.
What is it about people who want to become priests? What
was
his trauma?
Romantic.
Is it romantic to be?
Well, here's the other thing. My dad was really smart and he wanted to get a good education. The seminary offered
had
him
that.
So he got, classically educated.
But
in
you
got to
forego all the passions.
Yeah. I mean, it's such theater.
Really,
like church is theater.
Sure.
And now my dad has found his way back to the theater.
Yeah.
He's found like this troupe of guys at his bar and they just did Harvey.
Really?
And now he's like helping them write a play. I'm so proud. I love it. I haven't actually seen it yet.
So
I heard he did a wicked good accent last.
Oh yeah.
Which production.
Kind?
I don't know. Nobody could really identify what it was, but I got to ask him about that.
That's the best way to do an accent.
I think so.
He's doing one,
a
but I don't
bit
know what
vague.
It is.
Yeah. Just, you kind of can't place it. I specialize in those. Everybody thinks I'm, not American. They all think, or I'm deaf. They think I'm German or deaf. They think I talk funny.
But that's interesting. So you recognize it as theatrics early on?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I wanted it. I wanted to be part of it. I loved the church. I loved singing.
Yeah.
I loved punishing myself.
How many siblings do you have?
Four. I'm the dead middle of five.
So that's pretty Catholic.
Yeah. Yeah. And my parents even adopted one.
Really?
Super intense. Yeah.
And how's everyone doing?
I mean, they're they're Americans in the Midwest. It's not great. It's really hard. Yeah. It's hard to make a living. It's hard to pay your bills. My siblings have sort of various degrees. They're like, you know, we sort of are kind of representative of a certain kind of American family, right? That's been here for many generations.
Yeah.
You know, some of us went to college and some of us didn't. And,
yeah.
You know, one of them's an immigrant. And I mean, we kind of represent all things. So like, you know, I've got a chef.
Structure.
I have a general manager. I have somebody who didn't go to college who's kind of works in a trucking company. My sister who, you know, just kind of is, I think, mentally ill and struggles in the world mightily.
Yeah.
And, you know, is El Salvadoran. And,
uh-huh.
You know, and has the adopted child, like the always going to feel like she was abandoned on some level.
Oh, yeah.
It's really an intense psychology to be adopted.
Yeah, my brother has three adopted kids.
Yeah, it's really, and back then when my sister was adopted from El Salvador, which was in the middle of a civil war, they were just like, good luck, Christians. There was no trauma counseling. There was no sense of like, telling my parents, like, hey, get ready. There could be some real deep psychological shit going on here.
Yeah.
They weren't. And they come from a generation that, like, it's all stoicism. Nobody was going to therapy.
Even
I was
the
first person in my family to go to therapy.
Really?
Absolutely.
And is there a full political spectrum amongst the siblings?
No. My family's very classically liberal because my dad, again, he was educated.
Liberal Catholic.
Yeah,
that's
he
good.
Was like,
yeah, there was
he
a
was
whole
a humanist.
History.
My
yeah.
dad like understands that there are other religions,
yeah.
like that God, he believes in God, but he believes that God will appeal to different people in different ways, which
that's
I
good.
Think is a really respectful way to think about it.
Yeah,
and my mom's kind of like, I treat everybody the same. If that's wrong, I guess I am going to hell. Fuck
yeah.
off.
But the emergency room nurse, that's intense.
Yeah, it is intense.
So it's life and death
really
every day.
It. Yeah, it is. And she would just like smoke cigarettes at the kitchen table and look at the obituaries, see who died, you know.
But like that relationship, I talked to Noah Wiley about that he's got that new show on,
yeah,
The
yeah.
Pit.
Uh-huh.
Just, you know, your understanding and intimacy with mortality and the fragility of the human body, it's just like day in
it's
and
in
day
your
out.
Face. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think none of those nurses go to the doctor and they like all smoke. I mean, they're so aware of just how tenuous it all is. And I think my mom is not a person of faith. And I would say that she's probably on the spectrum, like very afraid of death. Whereas my dad feels genuinely prepared and at peace.
Ready
with
to
it.
Go.
Yeah, which his parents also were. They were practicing Catholics. They're like, oh, finally.
Yeah,
let me
it's
go.
Gonna happen. Yeah.
Yeah, and they were in their 90s. I mean, they also lived good, long lives.
What's interesting about that emergency room nurse or the smoking or anything else is that it's like it's got to be some kind of an addiction almost.
They're adrenaline junkies.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, they're so ready for this dopamine world we're living in.
They're prepared.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're ready to go. Like they got a bag to pack to help.
Yeah, right. And she was a really good nurse. I mean, she was really good at her job, but sometimes I think that also got the best of her. You know, like her energy was
exhausted.
Kind of put into that. Yeah, she worked at
and
night.
And five kids.
And she slept during the day.
Yeah.
And, you know, when Marianne Jean-Baptiste wakes up the new Mike Lee movie.
Oh, yeah,
you know how
yeah.
she like
she screams?
Wakes up and throws her pillows?
Ah.
That was the way my mom always woke up. It was terrifying.
That movie was gnarly.
Yeah, it's hard to watch, but he really does capture a certain kind of person who you're just like, oh no, what happened to you?
I talked to him. He's a beautiful man, that
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, well, he makes beautiful films.
Unbelievable.
We don't even have somebody who's treating the working class like that in this country.
He's a singular guy.
He really, I bet. I would love to meet him.
Like a real, like a humanist and a collaborator. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that all that stuff, it takes weeks to improvise, to find where the scenes are.
Fascinating.
It's crazy.
Process. I would love to be involved in a process like that. I think it's so interesting.
You should do a Mike Lee movie.
Yeah, well, you're right. Let me call him.
Dude,
that's not
call
really
him.
How this works, Mark. You know that's not how this works.
Well, sometimes
still
it is.
Still fighting for everything.
Are you?
Yeah, of course.
I kind of did a small crash course in some of this stuff you did, and I'm a little traumatized because I watched...
Oh, no, what did you watch? The Leftovers?
No, I watched The Nest.
Oh, yeah.
And
Sean
then I
Durkin.
Watched
so good.
Gone Girl.
Uh-huh, yep, first
but
movie.
But The Nest, I'd never seen that before, but I saw that guy's other movie.
Yeah, you liked Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. I listened
oh,
to your interview
God.
With Lizzie because, of course, you know, she's my pal.
She's the best.
And that movie's great. I mean, Sean's a great filmmaker, and she's magnificent.
What is it about that? You know, because I watched another indie movie the other night because my friend's in it. And there's a real difference between filmmakers who are just honoring a script in a very sort of basic way to execute the script, and then filmmakers who have a real full vision.
Yeah.
Like and it happens a lot with comedies, independent comedies. Mm. I don't even know why people do them because it's so like if you look at a script and it's, oh, this is a funny scene.
Yeah.
To make it funny on camera for everybody, you got to really have some magic or else it's just going to be like, no, OK.
Yeah. I mean, comedy.
But that
smart.
Guy, the guy who did The Nest,
yeah,
he seems to have a real understanding.
I mean, his scripts are all really personal. I feel like he's the one who's deciding what story he wants to tell. And then when he's on set, he's like, you know, he's like a great athlete.
Yeah.
You know, the really good directors, like that's where they're most at home is when yeah. they're on set and doing that work. And he and our DP, Matthias Erdely, who's an amazing DP, they communicated telepathically. I've never seen anything like it. Huh. They would just kind of walk around in a circle, putting their, you know, stroking their chins, and then they would just nod, and then we would do the shot, and they never said a word. And then pretty soon you found yourself also being like, Sean would say, Carrie, and you'd say, uh-huh, yes. And you knew exactly, it was so strange. I've never experienced anything like it before. But I loved it, and I loved Jude, and I love those kids. We just had a great time.
But it's like, I can't, it's weird.
Nobody saw it.
Really?
No.
They should
see it. Came out during the pandemic. I know. It's a really good movie. Well, it's an adult movie. Like,
totally
it's a
adult
movie.
And it's surprising in a way that's not overwrought.
Yeah, thanks.
Like in the sense of like how that character of him reveals itself.
Yeah.
In that one scene with the mother, you're like, oh, this
yeah,
monster.
Yeah, that's such a great scene. I know,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And he's like, I mean, Jude would say, I think, it's like there's so much of his father in it, too. Yeah. It was very personal.
And it's a
Jude.
Completely real sort of depiction of a type of guy and a type of
Absolutely.
Woman and the kids. And Gone Girl, that was great. But I mean, I know you've done a lot of other stuff, but this is what's in my head. And I watched all the episodes of White Lotus.
Oh, did they
sent
give
me.
You 1 through 6?
1 through 4.
They gave you 1 through 4. Oh, so you haven't gotten to like when the ladies go crazy yet, have you?
I can feel
There's
it coming.
There's a lot of setup. Yeah, of course. Of course. It's all going to.
And you were in Thailand?
Yes, for 6 months, man. Tracy was taking care of the kids for 6 months.
Is that how you got it worked out? You don't work?
Well, yeah, there's a bit more taking turns now.
Yeah?
Yeah, we just don't want to like. There's a version of life where you take your kids all over the world and just like plunge
them
wherever
you are. I know, I talk to actors that do that.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of always thought we might be those people.
Yeah.
When my son, all the way up until the pandemic, when he was 2, he'd been all over with us all around the world and on sets. And then the pandemic hit, and then we found out maybe he's like not that kind of kid. And
what,
they kind of tell
disruptive?
You. Disruptive? Yeah, like he really likes his routine. He loves school. He yeah. loves his school.
Yeah.
And we just don't feel good taking him out.
I don't know that any kind of kid is necessarily like that. That's where the whole sort of selfishness of the parent
yeah,
comes
that's
in.
True. It's like your family culture, isn't it?
Well, what's the bargain? Like, do they miss having a parent for 6 months? Or
right.
do you drag them wherever you are to, you know, watch movies in a strange apartment?
It's pretty tricky. Yeah, exactly. It's weird. I mean, I was going to bring them to L.A. because Tracy's in New Zealand. And I was like, are you crazy? Like,
how long is he in New Zealand for?
Like 3.5 weeks.
Oh,
not,
okay.
Not
that's
6
not
months. It's not the same as 6 months. But yeah, you really have to weigh all those questions. It's hard to balance 2 careers.
Yeah, I think I have 3, but I have no kids. But the level
yeah,
of
right.
worry I have about my cats is it's unnatural.
Yes, right, of course. Well, animal, it's very pure that, you know, the animal thing.
I guess that's what it is.
I like being away from my kids. I mean, I say that with love.
Yeah.
It's as a woman, it is very powerful to recover your autonomy period.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't think most moms, in the way we're parenting now, get to do that. So,
that's interesting.
As a cat mother, you're, you know, of course you're.
Well, yeah,
obsessed.
it's ridiculous in a
yeah,
way.
Yeah, and it's such a pure kind of grief, too. It's horrible. Having animals is horrible. I had them growing up, and I just don't want them ever again.
Really? Because
that's death. That's where you learn about death.
Well, it's where you learn about
when
death.
When you have 21 dogs since you're 6.
And you have to do it.
Yeah, you have to bury them in the backyard and
well,
hope you don't hit
somehow,
one.
You have to get them dunned.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, I know. We had one. My grandma and I ended up putting it down. And the vet was like, oh, just so you know, that was a flesh wound. She probably would have survived. And we're like, well, thanks for telling us.
Shut up.
I'm like, great. Now I have to go tell everybody we killed the dog.
Oh, it's the worst.
It's the worst.
I used to avoid it because we grew up with dogs. And my mother was more in the school of like drop them off.
Yeah.
And do it.
Uh-huh.
But the last couple, I went in like was there. It's awful, but.
You should be there, though. It feels like the right thing to do.
Yeah. But it's heavy, man.
It's so heavy. It's awful.
The sort of thing you got to do with your head. It's like, well, you know, you gave him a good life and
right.
he wouldn't have survived out in the wild and, you know,
yeah.
whatever. And you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Because when you're in that zone of like maintaining an animal's life, when it's ridiculous.
Yeah. We never got that far because we lived in the country. But yeah.
I was giving
I've seen it.
IVs.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen people pay us, you know.
It's crazy.
Ostentatious amounts of money to keep their animals.
You
got to
let them go.
You do, I think.
Yeah.
I think you do.
Yeah.
That's my personal philosophy.
So wait,
let
did you,
go.
What did you do when you were a kid? Was there an active farm?
I mean, it was not an active farm. It was like an old farm. We had like apples and blueberries. We didn't have animals.
Okay.
But there were animals across the street.
Yeah.
You know, there was a guy with chickens who probably shot 6 of my dogs, I think. you know, they were dying all. We used to do this thing at Christmas where we would recite all the names of the dogs and how they died at Christmas.
Yeah.
Because it would make my grandma laugh so hard. She'd just fall off her chair laughing. everything. We'd be like, Abby, Maggie, Yukon, you know, this one was shot, this one was poisoned, this one got hit by a car and then shot. You know, yeah. We would just go through the whole litany of dog death. Well,
there is something about country people's relationship to animals.
Yeah, it's more visceral.
Yeah.
I mean, your relationship to death and animals and land. We've gotten so far from death. It's probably good to, you know, have your hands in the dirt that way, but.
I think so. I don't know. My dad's in the throes of the dementia thing.
Oh, dear. That's a hard one.
And I detach from it. His wife's still taking care of him.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I'm feeling... I think after somebody you love dies or you see enough of it, that you realize, like, well, this is inevitable.
Yeah.
And grief and loss is inevitable.
Yes.
On some level.
Yeah.
And that's just part of the thing.
Everything you love will die and pass away. Everything
if you don't go first.
Right. That happens too.
Yeah.
You hope for the natural order of things.
Yeah.
It doesn't always go that way, of course.
But when you're growing up, I mean, when do you start doing the acting business?
Oh, you know, my mom hates this story, but I saw a play when I was 10 at the Akron Civic Theater, which is one of those atmospheric theaters where they have like the stars and on the ceiling.
Oh.
It was so beautiful.
Yeah.
And there were 10-year-old, it was called Babes in Toyland.
How
and there
old
were kids
were you?
My age. I was probably like 10.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, those people are my age and they're up there.
Yeah.
How did they get to be up there?
Yeah.
And I came home and I knew my grandfather after he fought in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II and he made it out. Yeah. Really intense. He just passed away last year.
Did he talk about it?
Not until his 80s. You know, when the Leopoldville surfaced, there was the sinking of a submarine that had been covered up, I guess, for decades. His battalion was on the Leopoldville being transferred somewhere and he wasn't on it because they put him on a Jeep to drive something somewhere.
Yeah.
So he had this sense of like having shirked death in that circumstance.
Survivor's guilt?
Yeah, a little bit. And so that's when he started talking about it. But he didn't like to be with other veterans. He didn't like talking about it. He didn't want people to know.
It seems like that generation doesn't.
No. It's so traumatic. I mean, can you imagine?
No.
The growing up you had to do?
I can't imagine.
No, I can't either. I mean, he would talk about like, you know, seeing his commanders get blown to smithereens.
And he was tracking through the snow?
Was in Arles in France. I don't know what... It was, I mean, it was just
But
it
wasn't
horrifying.
Like, that wasn't the one from Saving Private Ryan.
No,
it wasn't
that was Beach like D-Day.
Thing.
No, but it was a terrifying
The Battle of the Bulge, I thought, was in the snow where they were pushing back the Germans who were off. It was towards the end of the war, right?
It was. He
didn't talk about it.
The fact that he actually made it. Yeah, none of them did. They didn't talk about it for decades, I feel like.
I know, I just watched that. You ever see The Straight Story?
No.
The David Lynch movie?
Actually, we own it because Tracy's insane.
It's a masterpiece,
DVDs.
And it's not a weirdo movie. It's not like a freaky David Lynch thing. It's a very straight story.
Okay, well, there's a
scene in there between two
it.
Veterans. It's like mind blowing.
Oh,
Richard Farnsworth.
Oh wow! Oh wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll check it out.
Oh, it's.
I can't believe I haven't seen it.
You got to see it.
I'll yell at Tracy.
I keep talking about it. I met some guy at the deli last night after I did comedy.
Yeah.
And I was like, "You've never seen that?"
That's how I felt when I saw Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. I feel like I was telling everyone to go see.
I know. I do that all the time. Yeah. Like I discover a movie that's been around for decades.
Right. Well, that's why Tracy and I wanted to start like a blog I don't know what you do now, a podcast or because I feel like we have all those movies. We own them. And so, you know, when our babysitter, we have this babysitting friend of ours who comes in, she's an actress and she hadn't seen like Dog Day Afternoon. She hadn't seen Deliverance. She'd seen memes about Deliverance, but she'd never seen. And like so many kids in this industry have never seen these films.
Well, Deliverance, I had to go back and watch because I was brought to it by my
really
grandparents.
Oh, wow.
When I was like 11.
So dark.
And but like it's weird what you remember.
Yeah.
I did learn something about kids' brains. Mm. Is like I didn't really register the rape.
Right.
You just register the scary parts.
Right. Yeah. The portent. You feel it.
Yeah. But like when I saw it again, I'm like, wow, really show that shit.
Yeah.
I mean,
they really do.
Yeah. But
you're right. You don't process it.
No, because you don't have the point of reference.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. It's true.
You shouldn't.
So you're 10.
Yeah, I see a play and I come home and I look in the... So I was talking about my grandfather because he ended up doing some community theater when he got out of the war.
God, all these actors around you.
Just
these
one.
Late, these
he was the
but your dad.
One. Oh, well, he's, I think he's just... Now he's just competing with me. No, I'm just, he's so sweet. I think he did a little bit in college. But, and I saw the Weather Vane Theater where it was still existed and they were holding like general auditions or something. And I said to my mom, can I do this? And my mom was like, no, because my sister and I babysat our little brothers every weekend.
Yeah.
And my mom worked at night. And so she slept during the day. So she didn't drive us anywhere.
So it's practical.
So if we ever wanted to do, she's like, if you can find a ride. We were going to the grocery store and buying her cigarettes. You know, that was the time when you could, you had a note and you bought your mom cigarettes. So
yeah, I did that.
We all did.
Skaggs drugstore.
Yeah, totally. Right. We all had our, we went to Acme or whatever. But so I didn't do it until senior year in high school. I was playing soccer. I was an athlete. I auditioned for the play. I got the lead in Our Town. And then I ended up doing like four or five plays in college. I was also
an athlete. Where'd you go to college?
The University of Mount Union, it's called now. It's a small school in Ohio.
Ohio.
Again. It's just like they let me play soccer and they had a little bit of support for academics.
Did you study anything that resonated?
I changed majors like eight times. I was a business and Japanese major for the first 2 weeks.
How's your Japanese?
Terrible. I changed majors immediately. I was like, business? I'm insane. And I think I ended up in education for a while. And then I did a classroom observation. I was like, I'm not special enough to be an educator.
Yeah.
And then I did philosophy for a while.
How'd that go?
You know, I loved it, but, you know, I had enough credits to become an English lit major. And I studied abroad in Spain. And I became a Spanish lit major, but I did not study theater.
How's your Spanish?
Oh, God, the past tense is really gone.
Yeah.
I'm trying to practice. I try to, like, every year I'm like, my Duolingo is this, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm terrible and I'm so sad. I mean, it would come back if I made the effort, but I don't have time to do anything.
Yeah. But so did that sort of engage you in the arts somehow?
Well, I did plays in college and I had a professor who said, I think you could go to graduate school for acting. Now, I grew up in Ohio. I didn't know about Juilliard. I didn't know about NYU.
Yeah.
So I didn't have any aspirations. So I ended up at UW-Madison in Wisconsin.
Madison.
With 10 actors for 3 years. They were remaking the program.
Good town.
It's a great town.
Yeah.
It's a great college town. A lot of
fun. I like playing there.
Yeah, I bet. It's fun. It's a great, you know, it is. It's, I loved being there. But, and it was a great place to pay attention to myself for 3 years in my 20s.
So the program was small?
Yeah, 10 actors, 3 years.
Good attention from an okay teacher or what?
Yes. You know, they were, I feel like my teachers were very different and had different philosophies about what we were trying to accomplish there. But I had a great voice teacher, Susan Sweeney, who'd come from the PTT program in Delaware, which is kind of a notorious EST program.
Yeah.
They try out all the EST technology on those kids.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway. But and she was a great voice teacher.
Did she have it
teacher.
Or did she run
She had
that?
Some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. She used it effectively to get in there for us. But I realized having been from the Midwest, I had never maybe taken a deep breath. My voice was not in my body, and so that
was the
really
angle. Was a be present and self affirmation, and what? Was
I don't it? Think it's. I don't think it's self. I mean, have you ever gone to the Landmark Forum?
No, but I know people. I guess it. Yeah. Is it a sort of?
I think that life is empty and meaningless, and it's empty and meaningless that it's empty and meaningless would be the overarching philosophy.
But it's ambition based. It's manifesting your best self to do what you do.
I think it's sort of like corrupted Buddhism. Like there is no self, so it doesn't matter what you do.
I know one guy who's in the Landmark Forum, and it's
you can't argue with those people.
Well, there's a confidence to it that's
there
annoying.
Is. Yeah, there is. Because they're like, oh, that's yours. That doesn't belong to me.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't hold them responsible for anything.
Right.
Because they're like, well, that's your experience that you're having that I did not cause in you.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating.
Sorry.
I can't really wrap my head around
it. I'm walking
it,
away. Aggressive detachment.
Yeah, it really is. But the voice work was amazing and really life-changing for me. So,
and so.
And then I just, you know, kept doing plays. Doing plays
but
in
then
Wisconsin.
How does it become in
a
Wisconsin?
Well, so I went to the American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, an amazing outdoor Shakespeare theater that's been around for a long time.
Did Shakespeare?
I did Shakespeare. I did Chekhov. I did, you know, they do Eugene O'Neill. They do the big guns out there under the stars.
Yeah.
And it's an 1,100-seat house outside. And you have to figure out how to fill that space truthfully.
And it's a membership thing. So it's pretty full usually?
I mean, the audience has grown up with them. Generations of families have been coming to the theater. It's a beautiful place. I highly recommend people go.
And you got to learn how to fill it with your presence.
You do. Your presence and your voice, which is hard for a little lady.
Yeah.
And you're in these, you know, you're outside. And so there's rain and there's thunder and lightning. There's all the conditions you have to fight against as well.
Yeah.
And you're in upholstery fabrics so they don't get ruined. And I was there. And a lot of the directors working out there were Chicago based. Everything's made of upholstery fabric. And like, you know, you have to be nice to people or they won't wipe the mosquitoes off your face when you're playing a dead body. And then so the directors, James Bonin, who worked at a theater in Chicago, gave me my first job in Chicago. And then I was auditioning at Steppenwolf and I was getting called back. And then eventually my first job on the main stage was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And that play ended up going to Broadway and I met Tracy. And that's the play that changed my life.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah, because we went to Broadway.
But But Steppenwolf, like, what generation of actors were there?
Well, I mean, everybody who'd founded it was gone.
You know,
Laurie Metcalf, all those guys had moved on.
Yeah.
It was the new generation. And Tracy was kind of like, I don't know what you'd consider him. Is he like third generation Steppenwolf or something?
Yeah, I guess.
So I was the one kind of coming in under him. And in some ways,
he wasn't there, though, when you were there?
No, he was. He played George.
Oh, so you were in company that production.
Yeah, this is like post, this is post August Osage County. I mean, he's kind of the man who was sort of responsible for funding the theater at that point.
Yeah.
Because of his plays. But Tracy and I were... Yeah, he and Amy Morin had played married like, 12 times or something by then.
Yeah.
And so that's where Tracy and I met. And then that play went to Broadway. And that's when I started going to casting directors in New York. And I had done I had done commercials and one guest star spot on TV.
Now, my assumption in terms of what Steppenwolf means and what was going on there, that there was a intense and angry and focused bunch of people.
I think in the early days it probably was because they were just like hungry students. The thing that Steppenwolf brings and why I think Chicago theater is singular is the ensemble ethic, that it's about telling a story. It's not about one person who stands out from the ensemble.
Yeah.
So it's always about what is the best choice you make to tell the story.
Yeah.
And that's a great philosophy for theater.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes Chicago actors really unique and special.
It's also, I guess, also why sketch comedy has taken over comedy. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It was never a stand-up town, but it was always an improv town.
It was, right. And it's a yes-and town.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's all ensemble, collaborative work.
That's right. And like TJ and Dave and the Herald was like the hour long, right?
Yeah, it's a lot to go through.
It's a lot. It is a lot to go through. But it's fun to watch. Gosh, it's a hoot. Sometimes Tracy and Mike Shannon do it with those guys, and it's really fun to watch.
They do the Herald?
Yeah, they do the Herald with TJ and Dave. Tracy was supposed to do it a few weeks ago in New York, but he had to bow out because I think everybody was sick or something. But
oh, my God.
Family, you know, blah.
So that must be fun.
Yeah, good times.
But so Tracy, like as an actor... What in so you played opposite him? He was your husband.
Yeah, I mean, no, I was playing Honey, so I was playing the younger. I mean, we're 15 years apart. I was playing the younger, the younger couple, and he was playing.
So you got
George
to sit there on stage watching him yell and.
Yeah, I mean, he's very. You know, it's funny, Tracy. He wouldn't claim to ever being an athlete, but he's really in his body, and as an actor, he's such an embodied actor.
Yeah,
makes him so great on stage. He's great on stage.
I know. I saw him in that Arthur Miller play.
Yeah, he was with Annette. Yeah, All My Sons.
Yeah,
he was beautiful in that.
He was.
Yeah, he really was.
But
good.
I talked to Mangold yesterday.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was so weird.
Oh, he had a great time with James. He loved working on Ford v Ferrari.
The life I live, you know, I get out. I was told he's going to be early, and I come out here to set up, and he's sitting in his Porsche in my driveway. I'm like, hey, buddy, you want to
come in?
Yeah, yeah. But I talked specifically about that scene where Tracy gets driven in the Corvette.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny.
It's the best scene.
Well, it's so, I mean, my grandfather talked about that scene till he died. He loved that movie. He loved to watch it when it came on TV.
Yeah.
That was his favorite part Tracy ever did. But yeah, because Tracy is really claustrophobic and he was genuinely afraid in that rig. The rig is really fast.
Yeah.
Mike, I remember he said that Matt Damon was like, man, you're so pale. Are you all right? And he's like, no, I'm not okay. So like the crying, I think, came easily, but it's so funny.
It's hilarious.
It's a great choice.
So, but do you guys talk about acting?
I mean, we talk about everything.
Yeah.
That's the nice thing about a marriage where everything's on the table is you talk about everything.
Yeah.
We like working together. We're great together. We we kind of have a production company. I'm very cynical about it. But, you know, I've done a lot of his plays. We haven't really acted together much since Virginia Woolf, but you're
available.
It's a weird way to fall in love. Yeah, totally.
Well, how did you fall in love?
Well, I mean, we just, I don't know. It was one of those, we were both in other relationships.
Yeah.
You know, which I was a serial overlapper anyway.
Yeah.
That was kind of my thing
that's
for a long time.
That's what people do.
It's what people do. It's how, if you don't know how, if you have no boundaries and you don't like conflict, that's how you get out of things.
Yeah, you just move into another thing.
Yeah, like, oops, sorry.
Well, this thing seems better.
Are you going to break up with me now? it's a terrible, I mean, it's such a
what
terrible
is it with
way
the no
the
boundary
world.
Thing? It's annoying.
Oh, it's nobody, I mean.
It's exhausting, dude.
We don't, I know, and you really have to be conscious about learning that stuff. If you don't know
because, or else you're just going to be drained.
That's right. It's terrible.
Yeah.
You don't say no to anything.
Yeah.
Everything has a cost. You're resentful of everybody. And it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible. But Tracy and I he had also had patterns like that in his life. And it was like, I see you over there. And like neither one of, we're not jealous people. Like we don't have any of those hangups.
So
we didn't want to ever be with the police, you know?
Yeah.
So it's nice to be in a relationship where we can always talk about like, well, who are you attracted to on set?
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, totally. It's so fun. I love it. He sees, like, Tracy's the kind of person who sees, like, everybody on the street when he's walking, and every woman. I mean, he notices every single woman on the street. And he always tells me, like, who he has a crush on or who I'm talking about. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's interesting to know what your partner's into.
Yeah.
I think it's, like, it's titillating.
It doesn't ever go over the line.
We don't really like lines.
Yeah.
Lines are really boring.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, life is short.
Finite.
And you know, it's like Tracy, you guys know, you both have lost partners in your lives, which is a devastating thing.
Yeah.
And what I think Tracy and you have probably spoken maybe a little bit about this, but, and I don't think he would mind me saying, I think Tracy understood then from a very young age, because he went through it, like he would never begrudge anyone a human experience.
Right.
In fact, the every day after that for him was a gift he got, was to continue living in the world. And I think he recognizes that. And he sort of embraced being a person of appetites and, like, acknowledging that we have these proclivities.
Yeah.
And actually, we're not really, monogamy is sort of something we've imposed on ourselves through, you know, we were supposed to have babies and die when we were like 30.
Yeah.
And that's not the way life is anymore. And
right.
So I think you have to stay, you have to kind of be open-minded about what is, what makes you feel, what engages you in the world and what sparks your imagination and where your passion is. And I think if you're willing to stay open to that, then you're living a more full life. And I don't think either one of us would want to keep the other from living.
Right. I guess the question becomes, like, you know, depending on what those passions or proclivities are in relation to compulsion and the damage it may do to your life.
Sure.
That becomes the tricky thing to separate.
Well, I mean, yes, because there's reactivity, and that's different. Reactivity, where you're acting sort of blindly out of your patterns of behavior.
Yeah.
You have to also be willing to unpack that stuff. And Tracy and I are both, you know, we're both in recovery. We both have done a lot of, like, AA, Al-Anon, therapy. We have a lot of that language in our house.
Oh, really?
I mean, I'm 4 years in. I think he's 31 years.
To Al-Anon or to the other one?
I'm actually, like, kind of double winner. I'm double winner. I'm AA, Al-Anon.
Me too.
I kind of started in Al-Anon, and then I was like, well, I actually don't need the other thing either. Our kids are being raised in this, like, incredibly even keel. Like, there's nothing volatile in my house.
Because you can immediately take responsibility.
That's
for
right.
Your
it
side
is about
whatever.
Taking responsibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mark, I had a very serious impulse control disorder. I mean, I was a skin picker from two. I've talked about it a little bit publicly.
A skin picker. Where does that come from?
Compulsive skin picker. It's
like your nails
an impulse control disorder. You know, like people who pick scabs, but then eventually it moved to my scalp. So I was, like, losing hair. And
were you a nail biter?
No, I was just skin picker.
Okay.
You need your nails to pick your skin, Mark.
Yeah.
And you know, it's an overactive grooming, but it's impulse control, and it was really debilitating for a long time. I also used it as an excuse to get out of, like, difficult conversations. Like, I can't have this conversation. It's really triggering me. You know?
Right, but were you able to track, like, the whole trauma business?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, because I'm talking about it a bit on stage now, and it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, cool. I think that's really good.
Well, I think the interesting thing about it is that, you know, trauma is relative to the impact it had on your life.
That's
so
very true.
The most profound traumas may not be the ones that have fucked you up for the whole game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's something very funny about that.
Yeah.
The one that's horrible, you're like, that wasn't
that
the
was
problem.
Fine. I moved through that just fine.
Yeah, it's the other thing, the minor thing.
Yeah, I think that's true, because I wouldn't consider myself to be, like, I don't have some, like, big, huge sob story of trauma in my life. I just have, like, the kind of, like, workaday, you know, Midwestern sort of alcoholism around.
Yeah.
Right, family disease kind of stuff.
Sure.
And it's like, who doesn't have that?
Right.
But, like, if it manifests at two with you picking your skin off your body, and then it continues to become really aberrant as an adult, and you're getting, like, infections, and you can't play soccer because you have a staph infection in your leg, or you have a wound on your body for 2 years. Yeah, that you kind of self... It's like, that's not okay.
What is it?
It's not sexy.
What exactly is the skin picking thing sating?
Oh, God. Well, it's like any compulsion. It's like hungry, angry, lonely, tired, bored, overstimulated, understimulated, not living authentically. I mean, all the triggers, their triggers, I feel like, are the same.
But a lot of it usually comes down to, like, having some control.
Yes. And I also found that it was what I've discovered in my process of learning to deal with it. And I would consider myself recovered.
Yeah.
Is that it's also like it's an absenting of self. There's a withdrawal that happens, right? There's a dopamine. There's a brain component, right? You create a stimulus that's actually chemical in your brain. That's the thing you're addicted to.
Yeah.
Like, everybody's addicted to now.
Yeah.
And I realized there was, like, you know, that there was an actual like chemical component to what was happening to me. But any impulse is about 90 seconds long. So if you can create space between the moment you have the impulse and when you actually complete the action, whatever it is,
it'll
whatever,
go away. Yeah.
You can actually start to like rewire your brain.
Absolutely.
And that was the stuff. What acting taught me was like acting is the opposite, right? Acting is radical presence.
Yeah.
And we speak of acting in like percentages, like what percentage can you be present on stage? I'm sure you feel that in a show, right? It's like the headspace an athlete is in. It's the you know, where you're just like in the flow, like
sure.
the flow state
sure.
of it.
Yeah.
And like picking is the absence that you go away. You withdraw from presence.
That's interesting.
And so it was like to find that was the thing that I really wanted to do in my life, acting, was the opposite of the thing that was controlling my behavior or it was really quite a revelation.
Well, it's interesting. Well, because both of them require self-erasure in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
That's true. Yeah, there is an annihilation of self.
Right. But, you know, when you're on stage, it's part of the craft and part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
And the underlying thing is to be present. But when you're doing things to either lose yourself
uh-huh.
or take or diminish yourself
right.
as a compulsion.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
speaks to some other weird thing.
It is some other weird thing. And I think that's what's led me down the road to like, I don't know, this question of, you know, in the sort of Buddhist philosophy where you're
yeah.
talking about like the no self.
Yeah.
And just sort of how the only thing you can be sure of is that everything changes. So that everything inside of you, there's no person there. There's no center for those things.
Yeah.
And the story that you tell about your life, and I
yeah.
don't mean to diminish anyone's trauma, but
yeah.
but like storytelling is powerful. And if
yeah.
you can start to let go of that story, then you sort of let go of the idea that there's any person at the center of it that can
sure.
be
and as you get
hurt
older,
or traumatized or anything.
Right. As you get older, it starts to fade anyways.
Yeah, it does. I don't remember anything anymore.
Yeah, I was trying to remember some part of a story that I used to tell about
right.
myself of an event that happened. And I'm missing details now.
Yeah, isn't that funny? And that was like the way you asserted who you were was
sure.
through like, here are my 10 stories
yeah.
I always end up telling. And it gets really exhausting
but
eventually.
I think at the core of it, though, like the idea of no self is mm-hmm. that like what I find to be down there is some sort of terror.
Well, I don't know. That's interesting. What do you
like
mean? Like that's the...
Well, just a fear, a mm-hmm. vulnerability.
Yeah.
That, and I think getting back to... you know, talking about trust.
Mm-hmm, right.
So that vulnerability that you have at the core of yourself that
yeah.
may not be attached to a self
uh-huh.
can be, you know, very young and based in some sort of strange abandonment or distance
sure.
or emotional, lack of emotional support or whatever.
Yeah.
But I find that when you get right down to it, it's this childish terror
yeah. Yeah.
of not being taken care of because you
yes.
don't trust
that anyone's actually,
do it.
Yeah, that if you say your need, that someone will actually be there to meet it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that kind of confuses the Buddhism.
But it's also very egotistical in a way.
Well, yeah, because your ego is fragmented, so you're going to hold on to whatever.
And you are fundamentally not trust, you're not giving people any credit.
Yeah.
You're not allowing people, like you're not allowing for the fact that you actually don't know what that person is capable of.
Right.
And that was the thing when I met Tracy that shifted, is that there was a person in front of me who I could tell because of all the life he had had, he was
yeah.
older than me.
Sure.
Like there was nothing I could hand him that he couldn't hold.
Right.
So finally,
yeah.
in a way that I never trusted a peer,
yeah.
there was somebody in my life that I could trust. And it wasn't like, it's not like daddy issues. It was like, oh, no, I can, like this person can actually,
handle
there's nothing
it.
I can say to this person
yeah.
that they can't handle.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's the gift where you start to go, oh, and actually, I've probably underestimated everybody on some level.
Sure.
Because of, you know, controlling information is egotistical, ultimately.
It's self-protective,
right.
Yeah.
But like, what, but then you come back to the note, it's like, what are you protecting, you know?
Right. Well, that's.
What's the self you're protecting?
What's the big
like
question?
And I'm kind of like, well, maybe there's nobody in there.
Well, that's not true.
I don't know. I'm starting, the older I get, the more I'm like, it's just like these impulses and.
Yeah, I know. Well, sure. You can break it down to a bunch of tics and habits.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right.
But that's something. I mean, it's so funny.
Yeah, it is something.
I used to notice that about, about old method actors.
Uh-huh.
You know, when they're clearly doing jobs that they may, you know, that they might not be all invested in.
Yeah.
They've still got these tics and habits.
Yeah.
That have carried them throughout all of
That's true. Something to rely on. And no one's going to be like, you know, maybe you should consider. No one's going to give you direction anymore.
That's right. So yeah, you know, lose that weird thing you do with your head.
You're right.
But so.
But it's more fun to, I think it's more fun to like know that's there and be able to.
Work around
Let go
it.
Of it.
Well, yeah. Well, I
and
mean,
you
I
make yourself. You
well,
know?
I don't do too much acting, but like when I really try to do it, it's mm-hmm. you know, my first. If I get cast in something that's not of type, mm-hmm. I realize like, oh, this guy's not neurotic, so I can just turn that part off.
Right. And do you find that liberating?
Well,
yeah.
Like yeah, because it's a crutch mm-hmm. to do yeah. the constant self-reflection thing. To have a guy that doesn't do that mm-hmm. is like, sure, why wouldn't that be good? But then you doubt, like, well, what's his inner life? Mm-hmm. Well, how's that going to matter if you can just turn off all this other, like, self-awareness and just live in this present where this guy doesn't take responsibility for certain things?
Right.
Well, that's nice for a little while.
Yeah, that is nice. Well, isn't that the lovely thing about acting? Is that invitation, though, outside of
I'm still trying to figure out whether I, you know, have any... I try to engage some choices mm-hmm. that are not me.
Yeah.
But I do think at a core level, and this is sort of an argument against the lack of self thing, is that mm-hmm. when you see people act... Mm-hmm. I think even the best actors, no matter what they're doing, you do see them.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. I mean, there's something about them that's also interesting or attractive. There's something they have, I guess, at the core that's interesting or maybe. Is that true for everybody?
Well, I don't know. I think
some actors are, I mean, I feel like there are celebrities and there are actors. I feel
no,
like
of course.
But celebrities are always kind of doing themselves.
But even the most immersive actor.
You know it's them.
Yeah, kind of.
I'm gonna take that on as a challenge to see who I can find that I think like remakes themselves the most.
But it's just interesting because I've sat across from like Ian McKellen,
right,
Sir Ian McKellen, telling him I don't really get Shakespeare, uh-huh. and having him do it, and then just go back to Ian McKellen.
Yeah,
and there was something very revealing about that. Just that approach mm-hmm. that you know, like he's just this guy, and then he does this thing,
right?
And I think more than other people, those Shakespearean guys, mm-hmm. they can lose themselves.
Mm.
Like sometimes those guys with that kind of deep craft
uh-huh.
can, you know, immerse themselves in something that is fundamentally not them.
Yeah.
And you kind of buy it. And when they return back, you're like, what the fuck did you just do?
So you see it, but you don't see that on film generally. Like you don't experience that.
Well,
with
I'm trying to decide whether I'm talking out my ass or not. But even when you work with the most immersive guys, like mm-hmm. I was in a room with Jeremy Strong for, you know, 3 or 4 days in a very small part where he was playing a big part. And he's a guy that lives in the character.
Yes, right.
But the funny thing about him is that when you're in the room with him long enough, like he'll talk like the character, but he'll let you know, like, oh no, I can talk about things that Jeremy talks about, but right. I'm going to do it
like this person. Oh yeah. That's a whole, maybe I'm doing it wrong.
There is no right or wrong.
Well, do you when you watch yourself, do you watch yourself and do you,
yeah.
And me too. And are you looking for the things that are your habits and,
well, no, because
them?
Of my experiences is still pretty limited.
Mm-hmm. I don't think of your experience as limited. How long do you think you can get away with saying that? I feel like you act a lot.
Well, I've been doing more of it, but to kind of find out, mm-hmm. you know, whether it is like whether the job of or the actual acting mm-hmm. Is worth it in relation to the sitting. It's really kind of this fundamental problem I have.
Okay.
It's like, okay, we're going to act for 3 minutes,
and then
you're
going to
sit for 3 hours. So
TV and film's different than theater.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
But you know, theater I haven't done since I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
But
Would you ever?
I almost expressed interest in it, and then when they told me the schedule of what it would take to get something up.
It's really
hard.
It's
like, oh my God.
It's really hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, 4 weeks, you know, putting it together, previews, and then we'll see if anyone comes and just...
No,
but I'm on stage, you know, every night of my life.
You're doing that all the time, yeah.
But what we were speaking about before, too, is sort of interesting about presence,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a comic, that there's something happening to me now that's never happened before.
What's that?
Which is like, you know, everything's pretty immediate and pretty life or death for me, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of what I'm trying to express. And yeah. I feel that there that my intensity speaks to that when I'm doing stuff mm-hmm. on stage. And I found that if, like, you know, look, you've got enough craft in place to where it doesn't have to be that dire. And you know, it might be a relief for the audience if you weren't so, you know, intensely needy for them to understand you.
Uh-huh.
And so... So like I, because I told my friend Sam, you know, in the midst of this, you know, global collapse and political collapse, mm-hmm. I was on the phone with Lipsyte and I was like, you know, I just can't, there are comics out there that are just kind of laying back. And I said to Sam, I said, I just want to take it easy. And he goes, he says, that should be your new special, Mark Maron, Takes It Easy.
That's good. But that would be really.
It stuck in my head.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That like, look, dude. You know, and I think the revelation of it was just that my audience is like-minded. They're sensitive, mm-hmm. creative, grown-up people
yeah.
who are experiencing a lot of despair and traumatic stress going on, mm-hmm. and there's no real solution, and I don't have them.
Yeah.
So, like, I had this moment where I'm like, I will commiserate with you for the first 10 minutes. Because I'm in the same spot you are yeah. with the same feelings.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we can judge the other side. We can do whatever. But what's more important is, like, how are we dealing with it? Yeah. And then after that 10 minutes, I'm like, all right, now I will entertain you.
Ah, okay.
But so that's new for me.
That's really?
The idea of entertaining.
Oh, that's interesting. Because, of course, I find you entertaining. I've seen your sets, and I think of them as very entertaining, even when you're talking about the things
that
I'm most passionate about, like the end of the world.
Right.
But
for me, it's very important.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's any less important, but I can shift the tone a little bit where I'm like, all right, well, so we just talked about Hitler. Now I have this cat.
Right.
So, like,
to the personal.
Yeah.
And then how does it feel? Does it feel differently in your body when you do that?
It does.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm not. What happens is if you get to that place, the self-consciousness
yes.
and the need for connection changes,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you have to, you know, you have to accept that, like, well, they're here to see me. So the need for attention has been fulfilled
satisfied,
already.
Satisfied, yeah, right.
So why don't
then
you open it
present.
Up a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of the acting thing with watching myself,
mm-hmm.
and it, not so much with comedy, but similar in that, I know when I'm like, oh, so that moment, you weren't there.
Uh-huh. Right. That, yeah.
And that's really what happens.
Uh-huh.
But I just did this indie where I had to play a lead and it was the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And all I know about whatever the fuck I did there, you know, I was ready. I kind of showed up for the job. Was that I never went home thinking I blew it somehow.
That's good.
For a month.
That's a nice feeling.
It's good.
Yeah. You're like, they got what they needed and I can go to sleep.
But also, like, I did everything I could.
Yeah, yeah.
I showed up for the thing
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't have done it any differently.
Well, that's good. And that's where your life is lived. Your life isn't lived in how the thing gets received in the world, right? Your life is lived in the making of it.
I guess.
It is.
I know.
You can't control the other thing.
Yeah, but why are we watching?
What do you mean, why are we watching?
Why are we watching ourselves and wondering, and why are we saying things like no one saw
because
that movie?
Because the next time you... Oh, well, yeah, no one saw that movie is a sad statement to make. But, like, also, I loved making the movie that nobody saw. That's where my life got lived. My life didn't get lived, you know, when it came out.
Yeah.
And, like, you get to then watch your movie, even if nobody else does.
Right.
And say, oh, there's that thing I do when I'm mad.
Yeah.
Maybe next time I'm mad, I'll try not to do that thing.
I'll try to do a different thing.
Yeah, and, like, that way you don't, then you are remaking yourself, I think, in a more interesting way. I don't know how successful I am at that, but I just know that that's something I'm trying to do.
So when you watch it, you can assess your choices and wonder if there are other ones?
Yeah, be like, oh, no, like I do this thing with my jaw whenever I'm playing, like that's not, if you're, again, it's just like the way you're, it's the same thing as reactivity.
Yeah.
Like if you're always acting in your relationships out of a pattern you have,
right.
and it's unexamined.
Yeah.
It's the same in acting. It's like, oh, I always do that.
Right.
When I'm playing a character who's mad, it's like, why are my shoulders up to my ears every time? Why can't I stand up straight? You know?
In life, I don't know why I can't stand up straight.
I mean, it's a fundamental question that our grandparents were always asking.
I know what it is, though.
Oh, well, that's good, as long as you know.
I'm hiding my non-existent stomach.
Oh, see? Aw. At least you know. See, that's not unexamined.
Yeah, but I got it. Like, I wrote on a note for that movie. I'm like, don't slouch. This guy doesn't slouch.
Look at you taking notes.
I know, but I don't think I locked in.
You're like, in some scenes you did. In some scenes you did.
But with acting, in terms of, like, mm-hmm. you know, a right or wrong way to do it, I don't think, like, I was fortunate in going into that movie a couple weeks before I talked to Pacino.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Like there was some sort of mind-blowing thing mm-hmm. because like he's not the guy you think he is. And when you talk to him, yeah. he's just kind of neurotic, shy, you know, yeah. like guy. And like what he was talking about in terms of why he acts, mm-hmm. and I don't know why I never really fully put it together, is that as an artist, as opposed to just an actor,
yeah.
you know, he was in pursuit of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that was so mind-blowing to me.
Oh, wow.
Because I don't think I ever framed it that way. I knew about being present.
Right.
But I never saw the journey that presence implies truth in a moment.
Mm.
But the actual drive to act, you know, in any situation or any production is to find truth.
Yeah.
And
that's why I hate
it
when people
helpful.
Say actors are the best liars. I'm like, no. It's actually... It's the truth.
Right.
It's not lying. It's the other thing.
Well, yeah. Well, there's, I think there are guys, yeah, people who say like, well, actors are just good at pretending.
Yeah.
It's, but it's not
it's,
when
no,
you're in
it's,
it.
It's not that. It's actually radically the other thing.
Yeah. It, more so than in your life sometimes.
Yes. Yes. I mean, so many actors are so uncomfortable doing publicity or getting their picture taken. They're some of the most shy people I know are actors, you know?
Yeah. I remember when I talked to John C. Reilly. You know, he was like, I don't usually do this because I just don't want to. Yeah, he says, I want to keep up the mystique.
Yeah, well, there's probably something to be said for that. A little mystery is probably good. You shouldn't be operating at full disclosure.
And then we ended up talking about clowns for an hour.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's his stuff, right? He likes that.
I haven't seen
stuff.
Him in a movie in a while.
I know. I'm trying to. I guess the last thing was Tracy's show. You know, the winning time about. On the Showtime show.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
The last thing I remember.
So, like, when
John.
You, like, all right, so when you get cast in this White Lotus
yeah.
business,
uh-huh.
you know, what do you draw from? What, when you look at that and go, like, I can do this, you know, what was appealing about that
Well, the appealing thing was working with Mike White. I've always been a fan of Mike's work. I think Enlightened is a genius television
it's
show.
It's great.
Chuck and Buck, I love.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just think there's nobody quite like him.
Yeah, yeah. He's a
and the show is obviously, you know, in the business, everyone's trying to get on the White Lotus.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a part for me, so I auditioned for it. And I don't know, she wasn't, I do have a, whenever I read a script, I have a feeling like if I can picture myself doing it,
yeah.
then I'm like, yeah, this is mine. I'd like to go for this
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
Or I'm like, oh, you know what you need. You know, I'm always casting the thing for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really felt
I do that
with Lori.
Who turned this down?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Five people before you got to me. Yeah. She's not that far from me. Like, I feel like the script is contemporary and accessible.
Yeah.
And so there's not, it's not like the Gilded Age, right? It's not like there's a dialect and a corset or anything. You're just like slouching around in your bathing suit.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's an alcoholic, which I completely understand. And, I mean, Mike's so good at casting. Like, there's something essential in the person he puts in a part
yeah.
that makes them appropriate for the part. And then he's great at selecting for performance.
Yeah.
And he's also, Mike is not precious about his writing.
Yeah.
He's pretty like, he responds to what actors are good at,
suggesting.
I think. And he throws out new stuff. There's a lot of improv.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, he's also not arbitrary. So it's very exactly, like, he knows what he needs. And
yeah.
if he's not getting it, you will stay there until he gets it. So like you were saying about your movie, it's satisfying at the end of the day because you're like, I don't think we would have gone home if Mike didn't get what he needed for the show.
Right. You got to trust a director
yeah,
to a certain
you
degree.
Do.
I can't imagine what it would be like to not trust a director.
Well, you know, it happens. But,
yeah.
you know, you're like, well, I don't think you know what you're doing. So I guess I'll try to throw some stuff out there.
The director I work with on that movie, he's I wouldn't say he's neurotic, but he's very, you know, compulsive in terms of, mm-hmm. of how his brain works. So, you know, if he would give you, the hard thing for me mm-hmm. when I do it is like, where were we right before this? If you're shooting out of sequence.
Right. Oh, because you always shoot out of sequence.
How the fuck are you going to figure that out? But
terrible.
This guy was very diligent to the point where for the whole week. He'd like, write out where you were. And I'm like, I can't read all this.
Yeah,
dude.
You're like, actually.
Just tell me.
Five words or less. Where are we in the story? Yeah.
So what was it that got you into Al-Anon first?
Well, I mean, I don't want to speak too, my people are all still around.
Sure.
But there's, you know, I'll just say there's alcoholism in my family.
Right.
And what I came to understand is that I had some emotional habits.
Yeah.
Things about like not trusting other people,
and,
lying. I was a compulsive liar.
And enabling people pleaser stuff?
Absolutely. Like completely constitutionally incapable of any conflict or any boundary setting. So I actually had a boyfriend once who I needed to break up with him and I just literally stopped speaking. And he actually came over with like a pack of paper and a pencil
yeah.
and said, could you just write something down?
Yeah.
I mean, I could not speak. That's how terrible I was at asserting what I needed or wanted. So much so, I think for maybe men can speak to this too, but I know for women, it's like you spend so much time managing other people's emotions. As a middle child too, yeah. I was always aware everybody, you know, you're only as happy as the unhappiest person in any room. And then you like you lose complete track of what it is you even want. You're like, is it me that wants this, or am I just like reading what this person wants me to be?
Right, you just become a reaction.
And exactly. And I was just remaking myself in the image of whatever boyfriend I was with.
Yeah.
And staying with them as long as, and before, until I wanted to explode, but couldn't say that either.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like terrible.
Yeah.
And it was very, you know, like I said, controlling information is really egotistical. It
but that's interesting about.
They can't.
Right. No, right. Right.
And also, that somebody needs you, like they can't live without you. Right. There's that one too.
Sure.
That was one I really loved.
It's just egotistical, but also to speak to that, like what is self, mm-hmm. you know, when you live like that, you don't have one.
No, you don't. And you're so hyper compartmentalized.
Yeah.
Like you're just code switching all the time and there's nothing integrated about you as a person.
Yeah. And
you're just
but
an
also,
amalgam of a person.
On the other side of that. Now that we're talking about it, I think that's why you get into performing as almost mm-hmm. like, you know, a fuck you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like you can own your own space.
And there's unity in it. Yeah. And there's the right kind
boundaries.
Of attention. Yeah. Weirdly, there's probably like you have some control over the
but also there,
the building
just,
of the
you,
thing.
You have a thing.
Yeah.
It's a compartmentalized thing.
Yes.
We're all working to do this thing.
You also have freedom.
Yeah.
Also like nothing you're doing inside of that performance is no one else is being like, is that how you're going to, you know, there's no one judging the way you're living your life, which I was also deeply uninterested in. I didn't want people
sometimes
telling
it gets a little competitive, I think.
Sure.
That was the other thing that I kept thinking about when I did this movie was mm-hmm. when I talked to Ethan Hawke about doing Training Day. And he said he was watching Denzel Washington movies like they were, you know, training films.
Oh, wow.
Like football teams watch the other team.
Uh-huh.
Because he just did not want to get eaten for lunch.
Yeah, I mean, that's real. You don't want to get eaten for lunch. That's true.
Yeah.
If you care about what you're doing.
Yeah, it saved me in a scene with that scene with Sharon Stone. It saved me.
Uh-huh.
Because I had to do one scene with her. And after the first two takes, I'm like, I'm disappearing, dude.
Yeah.
I'm not in character. I'm just sitting there going like Sharon Stone mm-hmm. is consuming me.
Yeah. I felt that way with Holly Hunter. I know
you did.
Oh, completely. I was terrified.
And how'd you transcend it?
I was just like, I just have to be really memorized and really prepared and just like be really present. And I don't think I did. I think I was scared the whole time. She's terrifying. I mean, I love her so much.
Yeah.
And she was marvelous to me in this film we made, but she's a terrifying scene partner because she has that thing inside of
all
her where
in.
She's like a cat or like a live wire and you just like, oh, you could kill me.
Yeah.
You could actually kill me right now. You might.
Yeah.
I wouldn't see it coming.
Yeah.
And you just, she's so alive.
Yeah. The only thing that saved me was this stuff I got from Pacino's book. And I think it was like Stanislavski uh-huh. stuff. Go to the character.
Uh-huh.
Why are you there? Where did you come from?
Uh-huh.
You know, what are you doing?
Given circumstances, right?
Yeah.
And your intention. That's
right.
It. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Like, that's like, you know, it's acting 101 in a way, but it's like, that's, you always are like, oh, the basics,
it
right?
Saved
I have to
me.
Go back to the basics. Yeah.
I didn't even know the basics.
Well, it takes you outside of yourself.
Yeah. After melting down in my trailer, like Leonardo DiCaprio in Once Upon a Time
feeling.
In Hollywood, yelling at my manager, I'm like, I can't do this. It was a mistake. It's fucking God. Sharon Stone up there. And then
that's hilarious.
Having the moment where I'm like, dude, this is it. Mm-hmm. You know,
you're here.
You do the thing.
Show up.
Do the thing.
Yeah.
Do the guy. What mm-hmm. does the guy think about this person?
Yeah.
Why are you here? And fucking be in it.
Yeah. Get outside of you and your, whatever your neuroses
God.
Are. You got to check that stuff at the door. You can't make it about you.
It was crazy.
That's the nice thing, though, is that it can't be about you.
But everything's about me.
I know, like but that's the exercise you're doing, though.
I know, but the moment where you think you fucked up a take and you like that, those first two takes, all I saw was an entire crew going like,
They're not actually paying attention.
Yeah, I know. But in my, I was looking at every face going like,
it's and that's like, that's just narcissism,
day.
You know?
I guess.
It is.
It's helpful sometimes.
It can't, I mean, it's funny. I've gotten good about not, like, Vicky Creeps said something in her, you know, the great actress Vicky Creeps. She was talking about, she said that she now approaches the work in a take. She's like, how wrong can I go?
Yeah.
Like, how far outside of what this character is doing can I go? She said, that's what scientists do. They're actually like trying to narrow down into the thing by like kind of setting parameters that are far outside of what they're looking for. I'm like, that's a great way to think about it. And I just have always felt that kind of self-consciousness always has gotten in my way. So it's like to get out of your own way, you have to be willing to screw up a take.
Sure.
You have to be willing to like, sorry, everybody.
Yeah.
That was so bad, you know, and try again. And as a young actor and as a young woman,
yeah,
where you're trying to be a good girl and a good student,
yeah,
you're trying to guess what everybody wants you to do. And then you're not really making choices. And you're certainly not making interesting choices. And you're not giving a range of choices.
Right. But at some point, you got to believe that you're there because they wanted you.
And you do. You have to believe that.
That's,
you're right. You have to believe that.
That's going to save you.
And that I learned that like all the way back in Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, you got this job. You have this job.
Right.
And now you have to be in that room like you have this job, not like you're trying to get this job.
That's right.
You already have it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a really, that's like a little click, but it's really important.
Yeah. So, you know, I interviewed Fincher.
I love Fincher.
He wouldn't let us release it.
He wouldn't?
No, I talked to him for like 2 hours.
Why?
Because it wasn't, something wasn't right.
He's so controlling. God, I love him so much.
Why? What was it? What was it about? Was it? Did
oh,
you
he
have
was
the
wonderful to me. I had a wonderful experience. That was my first movie I ever made, Mark. I'd never made a movie before, and then I was working with David Fincher.
Yeah, but like, what about this? The reputation of like a
thousand
takes?
People knew they would get fired. You know, people were getting people get fired off of David Fincher movies.
Yeah.
I mean,
but what about the multiple?
Yes,
takes?
Absolutely. We did. We often did 88 takes or
Come
71
on.
Takes, and then every now and then you would do 5, and he'd be like. He would always use it to, he, you know, Ben was so happy to be there, Ben Affleck, because he's, you know, he's a director. He was thrilling for him to be working.
Yeah.
So he was always behind the camera trying to figure out what David was doing and why he was doing it and talking to the DP. And he's like, come on, you know, you have to be in the scene, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he was just giving Ben so much shit all the time. So he would, whenever we would get, so like I would get something in 5 takes, he'd be like, Carrie, that was excellent. Ben, could you be a little less somnambulant? You know, like he was such a shit. I remember there was one take with Kim Dickens. He's like, make sure you notice the cat, you know. And then Kimmy walks in and does the take. And he's like, Kim, it's the first time you've seen this cat, not a cat.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of his way.
Was she the detective?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's a very dear friend. We had a great time down there in Cape. They were all really, really generous to me on that job. But, you know, he's so, and my people are really sarcastic and really dark and just like always putting you in your place. So for me, it was love language. Yeah. So I got along great with David. And I said to David, I was like, David, you hired somebody who's never made a movie before. I don't know the language. I don't, when you say screen direction, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you explain it to me, I can do it.
Yeah.
And he was so wonderful. He'd be like, come here, look at the frame. This is really tight. You got to glide out on your foot. Okay.
Right.
Glide. Okay. You know? And he just taught me so much.
Oh, that's good.
But he's really, but he's like a, he's like an athlete in that he's like, he's got this incredible field vision.
Yeah.
He's seeing everything at once.
Right.
And that's why like you can't make it about you. If it's about you, he'll tell you.
Yeah.
But don't assume it's about you unless he tells you.
Right.
It's probably about the fact that I remember I heard him say one time to the DP, he's like, here's your frame. He goes, that's not my frame because my frame has 12 rafters and yours has 13. You know, like that kind of level of control. So intense, but I adore him.
And the shift from like, because a lot of actors don't have the stage experience you have.
Yeah. Helpful.
And yeah, it, like, but how? Because it seems like there's a...
Well, when you're doing a play, you rehearse for 5 weeks.
But I'm always yelling. And like, I don't...
Wait, yelling on set?
Well, when I'm on set, it's just a natural thing for me to go, how's it going? You know, like, I don't... Like, and then you're working with actors who are like, they're like,
oh, like the whisper
they're
ones.
Like, fine. Yeah. Yeah,
I know. We hate table... As theater actors, we hate film table reads because everyone's just like mumbling. It's like, I can't hear you. Can't hear what you're, it's just, we're just reading it out loud in a room. Could you read it out loud? I know Tracy and I are always laughing about that. Like, why are you mumbling in here?
But the sort of shift from, because you're still on stage in both situations.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I always feel like, you know, on stage, the thing about it is that your body is always telling a story in space. And so you have to be really economical.
Yeah.
Because any move you make, everybody can see it. And you will either distract or add to the story, depending on what you're doing. Like standing in front of a chair, but not sitting in it. You know, like that kind of stuff. And so when you have that experience, I feel like, then even on camera, you're maybe it's more embodied.
Full body,
maybe.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting because he said that about Tracy.
Yeah,
he's.
I always find that when people are in their bodies, I think it's really sexy. It's very appealing to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like I can tell actors who sometimes have like
even if
maybe
they're
just
to
been
claw
doing
out
TV
of
and
their
film
bodies?
Too long.
Yeah.
Yes, that too. That could be. That could be really visceral.
I'm in my body. I don't love it.
But you're aware of it all the time.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that counts. I think that counts,
okay,
absolutely.
Good.
I give you credit for that. Yeah,
so
I don't know. I think the theater. Also, in theater, the other thing people don't realize when they're like when the kids want to be famous in TV, they don't realize, like, I remember one of my jobs when I was doing a guest star spot, I held somebody hostage. And so I was like screaming and holding a gun. And it was like a 17-hour day.
Yeah.
So I was screaming all day long.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you don't know how to use your voice because you never filled an 1,100-seat house in Wisconsin,
sure,
you're going to lose your voice.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not easy to do something like that for 17 hours. And I feel like theater gives you a kind of stamina, too.
So what's going on outside of White Lotus? What's going on with his three daughters? Is that up for anything?
Oh, no. I mean, no. It was hopeful. Netflix took really good care of us, I think. And we had a great
It's a great movie. I like Ozzy. He's a great guy.
I know you got to speak to him. I adore him. And Tracy adores him. And
yeah, yeah.
So glad I got to work with him. And I love Lizzie and Natasha. We had a really special process.
Yeah.
That we'll always have.
Yeah.
We were hopeful that it could crack some. We're getting the Robert Altman Award of the Indie Spirits.
That's an
ensemble award. Yeah, that's a wonderful award.
When is that?
To get an ensemble.
Did it already happen?
Oh, no, it's this month. Tracy's flying in from New Zealand.
Is it down in Santa Monica?
I don't know, Mark. I'm one day at a time.
Yeah, I went there right once. Now.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think it's down on the beach.
Is
I don't
it?
Know. Yeah, yeah.
The beach where all the toxic ash is washing away into the ocean now.
Yeah, everybody's going to try to talk about that in a heartfelt way.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that. I'm going to present an award, I think, but I'll avoid all the earnestness.
I think I presented with Aubrey Plaza.
Oh.
And then I think Patton was hosting it.
Patton. I worked with Patton in Ghostbusters, so it was fun to work with him, yeah. Oh, wait. He thought I was in, what's the Pedro Pascal's show?
Oh, the
based on the video game.
The Apocalypse
Show? Anna Torv is in it.
Yeah.
And Patton, when he saw me on the set of Ghost, was like, oh my God, my daughter and I love your show. Can I take your picture? I was like, honey, Patton, I'm not Anna Torv. That's Anna Torv.
Did he argue with
you? And he was like, oh my God. Oh. It was so funny. He felt so terrible, but it was actually hilarious. I laugh now every time I see him.
Yeah.
It's great. He's just like, I'm like, no, Patton, that's not me, honey.
So when you do these movies, if it's like a Marvel movie or Ghostbusters, you just look at it as like, this will be fun?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jason Reitman's first Ghostbusters script, the Ghostbusters Afterlife, felt like an indie film. It felt like a Jason Reitman independent film. And McKenna Grace is a great young actress, and the fact that she was going to be the protagonist of the movie was great. So that felt like an indie.
He's good. He's an intense guy.
And Jason's
I've
really
liked
particular.
A lot of his movies.
I like Jason a lot. Yeah, he's a friend.
That Coney one, he did good.
Yeah, that. Up in the Air, right?
Oh, yeah,
that was kind of the one that put him on the indie
map. I love that movie.
I know, it's a great movie.
There's movies like that that I can watch again and again.
Well, I mean, like I have over 10,000 DVDs in my house, so we don't have time to rewatch.
To really rewatch?
No.
I'm finding I do it more now just to keep my brain out of the shit.
That's nice. Do you find it comforting?
I get very engaged with movies. They fuck me up pretty hard because I think my lack of boundaries, somehow or another.
You're so permeable.
Yeah, and so so movies, like when I leave a movie, I'm like, that happened in my life.
Oh, Mark, how are we going to get you some boundaries, honey?
I'm working on it.
You are?
Yeah,
are you?
Hostility, I think, help.
Oh, well, that's okay. That's another kind of reactivity to rely on, I guess.
An aggressive boundary.
Maybe you need to go that far and then, you know, come back from it, maybe.
I have to go back to Al Anon.
Yeah, you do. You do. You have to detach with love.
I do a joke, a line that only people in Al Anon get about. I got to decide whether I want to put it in the special because it's all about boundaries.
Uh-huh.
The arc of the bit is really just this whole relationship that was just horrible and she had mental problems. I have mental problems.
Right.
And it got to the point where after we'd broken up, she was just coming by the house.
Oh, no. Oh, that's not good.
And, you know, it's a little intense.
Yeah.
And I said, the truth is, I said I had to take out a restraining order. Mm-hmm. And I don't like to admit that. But what I don't like to admit more is the reason is that, like, I didn't think she
would. You couldn't set the boundary yourself?
That's right. I didn't think she's going to hurt me. I was afraid I was going to get back together with her.
Yeah.
So I had to get the police involved.
Totally. Oh, God. 28-year-old me really relates to that, Mark. I would have absolutely gotten back together.
But I talk about going to a men's Al-Anon group, you know, because out of panic. And it's just me in a room with 200 alpha doormats.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
It's so nice to see that side of masculinity.
Oh, yeah.
Guys are like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't seem to tell her anything. You know?
I can't break up with her.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, I studied abroad because I had two boyfriends.
Oh, really?
I was like, I think I'll just go to Spain for a while.
Oh, my God.
And my grandma wrote me this amazing letter where she was like, you know, she saw all of it happening.
Yeah.
She didn't learn to say no till her 70s, which she was very open about. And she was like, pity's not the same as love.
Oh,
And it doesn't dignify the other person. It doesn't give them any autonomy. Doesn't give any, you know, they're not making any decisions if you're not giving them all the information. It's like, I don't want to do this anymore. You can't say that to somebody. Yeah. It's awful. Ugh. And everybody eventually winds up where they should be, I think. Sometimes it takes too long.
Yeah, it's like it could have been a shorter story.
It could have been a much shorter story. People could have gotten on with it a little faster. Yeah. I know it's terrible, but.
Yeah, we'll be all right. But yeah, you seem good.
Yeah, I'm so good. I have an amazing life and I have a really good partner, as you know.
Tracy
is really special. I know he's a really special guy.
Yeah. Nice talking to you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
There you go. A lot packed in to that conversation. White Lotus is streaming on Max with new episodes on Max and HBO on Sundays. Hang out for a minute, folks.
Mit HubSpot und der integrierten KI erledigst du mehr als je zuvor. Dank Breeze Agents schaffst du in wenigen Sekunden, was sonst Stunden dauert. Und mit Breeze Copilot bist du immer 2 Schritte voraus. Mit den richtigen Insights zur richtigen Zeit. Starte jetzt auf hubspot.de/KI.
Wann hast du zuletzt eine Stelle besetzt und gedacht, das war einfach? Wahrscheinlich lange her. Recruiting kann echt kompliziert sein. Es geht aber auch anders. Die Recruiting-Plattform Instafo liefert dir dank AI Matchmaking nur passende Bewerbungen in deine Pipeline und per Chat kannst du direkt mit ihnen kommunizieren. Instafo erreicht über Podcasts, Reddit, YouTube und Co. Talente, die sonst schwer zu finden sind. Funktioniert für Enterprises wie RTL und GLS, aber auch für Scale-Ups wie Du Instruct und Finanzguru. Du zahlst nur bei Erfolg und sparst über instafo.com/podcast 500 Euro bei deiner ersten Einstellung.
All right, gang, on Thursday, I tried to get some answers about the state of our brains in this modern media and information environment. My guest will be Chris Hayes, who just wrote a book about all of this called The Siren's Call.
The addiction metaphor is interesting because I actually think, like, to me, I think it's the reason it's different from booze, drugs, or cigarettes.
Yeah.
And it's much more like food, is that it's unavoidable in the way food is. I mean, the thing about having an addictive or torture relationship with food is that, unlike other things, you can't abstain.
Well, yeah, sex and food.
Yeah, you can't.
Yeah,
you can't abstain.
Right.
And attention, you can't abstain from either. You're gonna put your attention somewhere at all times.
Yeah.
You're gonna be in your head at all times. You can't outrun it.
Yeah.
You're going to have to live with how you manage your attention, where it goes.
Yeah.
How you regulate it, in the same way that you're gonna have to put food in your body. And so I do think the addiction metaphor is useful, but it's not useful in the sense that abstaining is not an option. I mean, you can abstain from the phone.
Right.
But then you're going to have, like,
then you're
still
gonna
got
get,
the, you got the brain.
You're going to get real needy around the people in your life. You're going to start annoying your loved ones. They're like, why are you like this? I'm like, I'm just taking a break from my phone. And you've got to somehow match that, the amount I get out of the phone. Can you
gotta
do that?
Please entertain me.
Yeah. That full talk with Chris Hayes is coming up on Thursday's WTF. To get every episode of WTF ad-free, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some guitar from the vault. Some old stuff. Some classic riffs. Yes.
Thank you. Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere. All right. Okay.